You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs Program for Land's Sake. I'm Bill Kite, your host. Our guest today is Peter Hiller, who's been called one of contemporary fiction's most successful authors. Some of Peter's novels are The Dog Stars, The Painter, Celine, and his most recent release, The River, in addition to his nonfiction books, Kook, The Whale Warriors, Hell or High Water, and lastly, most important to me, Peter Hiller is a poet. Welcome, Peter.
Hey, great to be here, Bill. Thanks.
You know, by reading your works, you're obviously a lover of the outdoors, an adventurer, and an activist advocate for Mother Nature. If you could, give us a little background about yourself, what you'd like for us to know about you in this next half hour.
Well, I grew up, like a lot of people, you know, in the outdoors in the summertime. I was a city kid, but I spent my summers in the Adirondacks. I learned to canoe and climb. Loved it. Always hated the city. And I went to college in New Hampshire, and I learned to kayak. And I took to it like an otter. I mean, I just loved it. I didn't mind getting thrashed.
Right.
I didn't mind swimming too much. I loved everything about it, and I especially loved rivers and the way they took you into wild country. And one summer, I was a sophomore in college. I came out to Colorado with a few friends to paddle for a few weeks, and that was a revelation for me. I mean, I just couldn't believe you could paddle in the heat, because all our rivers ran in early April when there was still snow on the ground and ice in the water and stuff.
Right.
Back in Vermont. And I couldn't believe you could paddle in the heat. You know, your paddling stuff would dry out in 10 minutes on a sagebrush.
Right.
And that, you know, there were snow-capped peaks and there were herds of elk. And, you know, I just vowed to come back. And I got jobs as river guides after that. And after college, just in Hollywood, I kind of hated that too for a year. I just came straight back to Colorado and, you know, pursued mostly kayaking, and that led to writing in magazines about it and kind of going around the world doing trips. And then more and more, as I traveled the world in remote places, it became very clear to me that the ecosphere was unraveling and that we were losing things, habitat, and plants and animals at an alarming and accelerating rate, and I started to write more and more environmental stories. But I kind of came up as a poet, and, you know, I wanted to write poetry as a little kid, and I wanted to write short stories. I read Hemingway for the first time when I was 11, his little book of short stories, In Our Time, and I was kind of like, you know, I want to do that. I want to write prose that just kind of goes through your skin and straight to the heart, and I want to fish those rivers to be fished.
Right.
And so I grew up with sort of that ambition, but no one, you know, told me that you can't make a living doing that. So kind of mean to the people in school, but so I ended up writing for magazines, and then eventually a few years ago, I just thought, you know, it's time, and I sat down and wrote the first novel, which was really thrilling.
Well, you know, I like the way you weave the poetry into the painter in a number of places. So so that's obviously a passion you still have.
Yeah. I'm much more interested in the sound of the language, to tell you the truth, than the story. I mean, I sort of sometimes think plot is sort of silly. But when I start writing novels, you know, I start with the first line and just follow the music, the language into the story. And then, you know, lo and behold, I don't plan the books, you know, or plot them or anything. And stuff always ends up happening.
they take you where they want to go, then, the stories.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Kind of like being on a river.
You know, you jumped right in with both feet and really wanting to do something about the environment in many ways. And I think especially the Whale Warriors book that you were on the ship there with quite a crew. Could you tell us a little bit about that story? I think it's very fascinating.
Yeah, I was in Telluride at the Mountain Film Festival, and someone said, you know that guy over there? Big burly guy with a white beard and long white hair. He said, that's Captain Paul Watson. He's very controversial. He's sea shepherd. I think you should meet him. So I went over to his table, and he shook my hand. He said, I sunk half the Spanish whaling fleet and half the Norwegian. That was the first thing he said. And, you know, no one had ever said that to me before, and I was sort of intrigued. I went to hear him speak in the auditorium, the big auditorium there, and he spoke to a couple thousand people, and you could have heard a pin drop. But he had people just crying, you know, in their seats, talking about whales and getting harpooned right in front of him. And, you know, and then afterwards, he invited me to come with him on one of his campaigns to Antarctica to chase down and interrupt the Japanese whaling fleet. And I, of course, said, yeah, sure. It was supposed to be a month-long trip, and I was writing for National Geographic Adventure. And they first, you know, the society didn't want to assign the story because they didn't, well, two reasons. They thought their journalist might go native, become an eco-terrorist, and they didn't want to glorify or sort of lend support to what might be considered eco-terrorism. But I sort of convinced them, and they made me sign a letter, and Watson signed a letter saying that I was a non-participant, I was a journalist, and I had that letter laminated, so it was waterproof, so that when the Japanese sunk our ship, and I could pull it out of my dry suit and wave it. it ended up being, I thought it was going to be sort of, I believe that what they were doing was very interesting and important, and raising awareness about hunting whales in an illegal sanctuary and awareness about the crisis of the oceans in general. But I didn't have any idea what I was getting into. And I remember I had my duffel bag. I ended up getting dropped off by a taxi at the wharf on the Victoria Piers in Melbourne, Australia. And there, tied up on the dock, you know, in front of all these like prosperous cafes and restaurants, was this all black warship, basically. I mean, it looked just like a pirate ship, and it had a Jolly Rogers flying off the bow. It was all black. And I approached the ship, and on the superstructure was painted all these little skulls and crossbones with the names of ships underneath them, Isba 1, Isba 2, the Marild. And they were all ships that these guys had sunk or rammed on the high seas. And that sort of gave me an inkling. And then the ship's artist, who was a Hell's Angel tattoo artist from Amsterdam, He took me down to my berth. He said, oh, by the way, you have to sleep in your clothes. That's the rule. And I was like, why? And he said, because if we get sunk, especially in port, like the Rainbow Warrior did, by government or by saboteurs, the time it takes to get in your clothes could lose your life, So that kind of made me think a little bit. Then I found the ship was all vegan, and then, so I put away my fishing gear, and then 3 days south of Tasmania, they'd picked up a helicopter there. All the welders came on deck and welded a big blade to the bow, which they called the can opener, which was for, and they had a concrete reinforced bow, and that was for gutting the hulls of the Japanese ships. And then I realized that these guys were deadly serious and totally committed, and that everyone on the ship was basically in it. They would all die to save a whale. And, it scared me a little, and it also really impressed me that these people were so committed.
So how long were you with them?
It was supposed to be a month, but a month into it, I was exactly a month into it, and I remember calling my fiance and saying, hey, Kim, I know I'm supposed to be back in Denver day after tomorrow, but we're in a force-8 gale in 40-foot seas. We're going 9 knots, and we're 2,000 miles from any port, and we're, running out of gas. I don't think I'm going to be home day after tomorrow. I remember it was on the satellite phone. So it was 2 months, and we crawled into Cape Town on fumes.
Well, that's quite a book telling about that adventure, and I'm sure you have multiple stories you could tell just about that one adventure in itself.
Yeah. I mean, it was a great crew. I mean, what I realized was, I did turn, I was sympathetic, but on the ship I realized, that the Earth has, however many billion, 7 billion people, and the oceans are dying, and there was only 44 people on the planet willing to give up their lives to raise awareness about it. It impressed me deeply.
Well, I'm sure that would, for sure, definitely. You know, you have an amazing way to me about writing about the land. And it's the landscape in such a way that I feel that I'm actually at the place that you're describing. And if you would allow me to read from the painter here just a little bit, I kind of want to demonstrate what I'm talking about, if that's okay.
Are you reading from the painter or are you reading from the river?
From the painter.
Okay, yeah.
Talks about the road skirted the base of the mountain and dropped off the mesa. It narrowed and followed the creek. Along the stream, the big old willows and elms, the cottonwoods grew over the road, and their leaves were already starting to turn, and some had already fallen. I could follow a road like that forever, narrow and winding, tunneled with old trees and littered with yellow leaves. Dappled sunlight slid up the hood and over the windshield. The morning was cool. Clouds massed in the west over the mountains, but here it was sunny. And it's that's in a way that sing-song language you were talking about earlier comes across in your prose. It touches me. I really like the way you do that, so I want to commend you on that, Peter.
Oh, thanks. Appreciate it.
You know, speaking of the river, I really recommend the river to anyone who wants an adventure story, an outdoor story. Just it's hard to put any kind of label on it. I read it in 2 days because it was that good a read. And then John Waterman, a friend of mine, another writer, said the same thing. So I recommend you get it just as soon as you can, get your hands on it and read it. There is a passage in there that I thought was very good, and then I want to kind of ask you a little bit about how you developed that story and what made you pick a story about a fire, because I was a firefighter for a number of years in some of the really nasty fires, and I find your descriptions all the way from page 180 to way over to 191 to just be absolute right on description of a great big fire like the one that is in this book. And it's just a bit here. So as they walked into the embered wasteland of a burned forest, they sloshed with every step. They had their Wellingtons with about an inch of water in them, is why they sloshed. Maybe because the moon was not up and the light there was cast from exploding trees across the river. The sense again of pulse like blood or breath, like someone alive. The scorched landscape throbbed with light, otherwise black and red, black ground, black stumps, red embers, black distances between the flaring stumps. It was hot. And I really find that whole description there, it's almost like you've been to a number of those big fires yourself, fighting them the way you described that. So I did want to mention that. How did you get that idea for that story and develop it?
It's an interesting origin story. You know, I said that I start usually with the first line because I just like the music and the language and kind of go from one line to the next, and I follow the language into the story. And what I've discovered now, we're having written 5 novels, is that pretty quickly working that way without a plot or an outline, I bump into what I'm really concerned about and what I really want to write about. And on this book, you know, I started with these two guys. The first line is they've been smelling smoke for 2 days. And, you know, there's a fire off to the northwest and on a very remote river in northern Canada. And within a few pages, I bump into this story that sort of happened to me when I was 17. When I was 17, I was in love for the first time. I was at a little boarding school in Vermont. She was a New Hampshire girl, so right next door. And sometimes on the weekends, we'd go over to her mom's place, which was on the edge of the White Mountains, and she lived in a little cedar shingle farmhouse. The whole family was serious equestrians, and they had horses. And there was a field with horses and a barn, and down below the field, a little gem-like lake, and across the lake, Mount Chicago, a beautiful little Monadnock of a mountain. And Margaret had 3 older sisters and a single mom, and the 3 older sisters I thought were, you know, very attractive, and on the weekends, all the suitors would come out of the hill and friends, and they'd drive up from Boston and beat up Saabs with duct tape on the convertible part, and come, you know, over from Vermont, and everyone was broke, and everyone was a student or a musician, and so they'd have these big spaghetti dinners on Saturday night. And, you know, I'm 17, and I just thought this was the greatest thing ever. And one night, one of these, it was like October, Saturday night, and so we're in New Hampshire in the country, and this bunch of people, this guy was leaning against the wall, attractive guy in his late 20s, charismatic, it seemed like, one of those sad charismatic guys. He seemed really sad. People were treating him gingerly, and I noticed that. And then someone said, "Hey, Pete, you know, he makes his living in a canoe." And my ears kind of swiveled because that's what I wanted to do.
Right.
So I went over, I clinked beer bottles, which is what I thought you're supposed to do. And I said, "Hey, you look a little rough. What's up?" And he said, "Oh, I lost my wife 2 months ago." And turns out he was a geochemist, and he and his wife would do studies way up on rivers in Labrador and stuff, and they'd take these long canoe expeditions to do their research. And he said, "Yeah, we were on this river in Labrador. We'd been out a few weeks, and we were camped, and in the morning she went over the berm to use the bathroom, and I never saw her again." I was, like, shocked, and I said, "Well, was there a bear sign? Was it a bear attack?" And he said, "No, no sign." I said, "Well, did you look for her?" "Yeah, of course. I mean, searched for like 3 days, nothing." And I walked away from that conversation, and I knew he was lying. I mean, my antenna were just humming, and I was dead sure. And I thought, you know, that son of a bitch killed his wife.
Wow.
And I must have been thinking about it for 40 years, because when I started in on the river, you know, I started with those first lines about the fire and everything, and pretty soon I bumped into that story.
Wow. From real life, things come out sometimes unexpectedly, don't they?
Yeah. You never know what's going to float out of the universe from your past and land on the keyboard. It's really fun.
And the name you gave the river was the Mesquite River. Is that it? Mesquite?
Yeah. The real river is called the Winnisk. And that's sort of the other origin of the story. The Winnisk is as the Mesquite is written. I just changed the name. But a few years ago, I got an assignment to write a story about canoeing this river. And it's like the Mesquite. It flows out of a string of lakes and runs a couple of hundred miles north into Hudson Bay, the southern end of Hudson Bay. And it's beautiful. It's just a beautiful river. I mean, it's the Canadian Shield, you know, this big spruce fir forest. And then it drops off into the taiga, which is that spongy lichen moss, you know, thinner forest, thinner woods. And just beautiful, full of wildlife and northern lights. And, you know, it was August. And the gal I was dating then, we'd been on like 3 dates, and I thought she was kind of a badass because she showed up on the third date with a little duffel bag from her gym. And I said, "What's in there? It's kind of heavy." She said, "Weaponry." She opened it up, and it had throwing stars and two short swords and all this stuff. I was like, "Whoa." So she was training as a ninja, and she said she'd never been camping, but I thought, well, she's pretty tough. So I asked her if she wanted to come with me, and she did. And I remember we were packing up, and we were putting our personal stuff in these little blue barrels, you know, these waterproof barrels, plastic barrels. And she said, could I bring my eyebrow tweezers? I was so shocked. I mean, no one had ever asked me that before. Cut me some slack. I was in shock, and I should have been way more gracious. I said, no. I mean, how much did they weigh? Like half a gram or whatever, you know, no big deal. But she got me back because she loves fossils, and we're going down the river, and she's, you know, there's a lot of limestone shale with fossils in them, and she's picking up rocks and putting them in the canoe. We're getting lower and lower in the water, and we're, you know, running white water and stuff and losing our freeboard. And so I remember one morning I went to load the canoe, and there was like a 12-pound chunk of limestone with this little tiny clam in one corner of it. And I picked it up, and I said, "Hey, do you think maybe..." She looked at me dead level and said, "Don't minimize me." I knew she was someone to reckon with, and we're married now, so
oh, wow.
It worked out.
That was Kim, huh?
Yeah, that was Kevin. Yeah. The fossils are now in the front yard.
When did the writing bug first bite you, Peter?
I was writing poetry when I was like six. My dad used to read to me every night before I went to bed, and he would read poetry to me a lot. He read E.E. Cummings to me when I was six, and I still remember Buffalo Bill's Defunct, and he read Yeats to me like at 11, and I didn't understand the stuff. You know, thank goodness, especially the E.E. Cummings. Some of it's kind of racy, but I loved the music and the language. I just thought it was the greatest. And then, you know, he's reading stories to me, Treasure Island, all that, The Hobbit, and stuff like that. And I just love the storytelling and the poetry.
You're listening to KDNK's Public Affairs program for Land's Sake. Our guest today is author Peter Heller. I also enjoyed reading Hell or High Water. And it started out with just a terrible tragedy, didn't it, in that book?
Yeah, that was my first assignment. I was living in Boulder. You know, as I said, I came back to Colorado after school, and I was sharing a house with a friend in Boulder, and, you know, we were both kayakers. He taught me to kayak. His name's Landis Arnold. A lot of people listening probably know him. Dear friend, he was an Olympic ski jumper, and he was training, I remember, for the Olympics, and we were paddling, and I was doing every odd job. I was teaching kayaking and delivering pizza and working some construction, all that kind of stuff, and I was writing poetry, and one day one of my buddies said, hey, why don't you combine your interests? Why don't you, you know, write for Outside Magazine? I thought, oh, when you're young and dumb, you know, you don't know what you can't do, so I went down to the magazine store, and I got an Outside, and I looked on the masthead for a senior editor's name, which sounded nice, Laura Honhold. I called the 800 number. I said, hey, is Laura Honhold there? You know, she said, just a minute. Laura here. And then, you know, I was like, oh, crap, she's there. I started talking really fast. I said, hey, I just had a short story published in Harper's, which is sort of true, just this little reprint in the reading section, and I said, you know, I think you should send me to the Tibetan Plateau to run this river. And there was this incredulous pause, and she said, you know, I'm going to take a chance on you. We've heard about this expedition, this first descent. We don't have a writer that can kayak class 5, and I'll pay half your expenses, and if you write a good story, I'll pay the other half and buy the storage. So I was all excited because I needed a new paddle. Mine was all duct taped together, and I went on the trip. And, you know, I won't tell the whole story, but a guy died on the first day. He died in my arms, me and this other paddler, Scott. And it was rough. I mean, it was really, really rugged. And, you know, I came back and I said, you know, I can't write the story. Sorry. And she said, what happened? I sort of vented for like 45 minutes. I mean, I think I was, you know, I was traumatized. And she said, you just go write that. And that was their submission for the National Magazine Award that year. And it was a strange way to start in journalism. And I knew that if I didn't get another assignment right away, you know, paddle something hard, that I might not paddle again. So I got this story from Playboy, which was funny because you kind of think it's an indoor magazine. But they gave me this assignment to go with it. It was a Kiwi-Russia expedition to a river called the Muxu in the Pamirs. And was supposed to be like the Everest of rivers of the old Soviet Union. And it was a great trip, you know, perfect antidote to the nobody died. You know, the people that had tried it before, the last attempt had lost 5 of their 11 paddlers. And so, you know, we went, and it was Kiwi Russians. It was great because Russians and Kiwis are like oil and water. And like you get to a tough rapid. It was, they were all in rafts, and Roy Bailey and myself, he's a Kiwi kid, were the two kayakers that sort of went out front, just kind of scouted. And you'd sort of signal everybody over and everybody eddy out and climb up and look. And they'd be looking at some, you know, little gorge rapid, you know, and some extreme thing. And the Russians would squat and start chain smoking and get all grim. Like the way to history, you know, told story. And the Kiwis would be hopping around the bank, oh, she'll be right, no worries, you know, I see a line. And it was just a great contrast. But everyone got along, and the guy that had to navigate between the two teams was this guy Vanya, and he learned all his English from Frank Zappa records, and he could sing every Zappa song, like Quin the Eskimo and everything. And one night, this is such a great story, I just have to tell it, but one day he said, Pete, last year I was in the same region doing geology expeditions. This is in the high time years above Afghanistan in Tajikistan. He's like, and in next drainage over was international expedition looking for Yeti, led by French scientists. So he said, one night, Pete, I have Swiss Army saw. I cut out of plywood raft deck, I cut foot. And then I put handle on, and then, you know, like Rocky Creek with snowbank, and then I make tracks in the snow like this. He made the motion.
Oh, no.
And next day, Pete, they found the tracks and made international headlines. It's true.
Oh, no.
He said, but only one problem, Pete, was all left feet.
Wow.
So, anyways, that was a great trip. So that was the second story.
In the minute we have left, what recommendations would you make to a young writer wanting to do what you do, Peter?
Yeah, I would say just read. Read poetry, read short stories, read novels, read historical fiction and biographies. Read a lot and write every day. And I guess the most important other thing is use your senses. You know, the readers trust the senses more than they do the think stuff, the brain stuff. So, use your senses as often as you can to describe all those little details.
Great advice, Peter. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Real pleasure, Bill. Thank you.
Don't forget, folks, to go out and get your copy of The River. You won't be disappointed at all. Thank you for listening to KDNK. Our next show is May the 14th at 4:30. Until then, whatever you do to Mother Nature, do it for land's sake.